This week on the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast, we get a primer on gender identity.
Sex is what we assume is in your pants. Gender is the pants themselves. Like, how are they cut? What fabric are they made out of? Who are they friends with? What job do they have? It's about the pants. And sexual identity or sexual orientation is what you do, or what I assume you do, when your pants are off.
And engage in a conversation about what this means for fraternities, sororities, and their membership.
And you can look at your history, your purpose, your values, and you can say, you know, because these values are critical, so critical to who we are, we can only admit men, and this is what we believe a man to be. And at the time of initiation, when we actually make that membership decision, you have to identify as a man. But after initiation, we believe in supporting all of our members in their lifelong journey toward brotherhood or sisterhood, regardless of what happens.
Hello, and welcome to the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast. I'm your host, Matt Deeg, and I'm sorry for the month-long radio silence. Gearing up on school took a little more out of me and a little more time than anticipated. But hey, we're back, and we've got some exciting episodes coming up. In a time when conversations about race and identity are at a high point, I hope the coming conversations can spur some additional thinking and discussion for you and your colleagues and students. Last year, around this time, TimeHop reminded me that I was chatting with Panhellenic women about how important it was for students, especially Greek students, to be civic-minded and engaged. And now? Well, important times 100, at least. But we can't be ignorantly engaged, repeating the talking points of our favorite hosts or what we see on our favorite television channel or Twitter feed. We need to pursue knowledge and understanding so we can make up our own minds and be willing to engage with intelligence. So I'm glad to welcome some experts in areas surrounding identity and race to the FSL podcast. They won't answer all your questions. They won't do all the labor for you. But what they will do is provide a good starting point. And at the end of our conversations, they'll provide some resources so you can further educate yourself and others. So here we go. FSL Podcast, Diversity and Inclusion Focus, Part 1. And now, our guest for the day. Stevie Tran is a practicing attorney based in New York City who pursued the issue of trans membership as a result of her membership at Arizona State and continued alumna involvement with her organization. She has several publications regarding trans membership and fraternity sorority life and continues to work with international organizations to increase their inclusion efforts. Our other guest is Jessica Pettit. Jess is a social justice and diversity facilitator. Before jumping into that role, she received her master's in higher education at the University of South Carolina and worked in student affairs in a variety of roles. She serves on the NPC's Gender Identity Study Group and continues to be a passionate partner for fraternities and sororities as they further their inclusion efforts. Both of our guests jumped on a call with me this week, and here you go. Hey, Jess. Hey, Stevie. How are y'all?
Hey.
Hello.
Oh, I love the personalities coming through. That's fun. So, well, I want to thank you both for joining me and sharing some of your knowledge and your experiences. You know, I was telling y'all before we kind of got started here that this is an area that I don't know as much about, and I think many of our listeners probably don't know as much about as they do, say, the intricacies of, you know, the Green Book or an intake process or something. So I think for both my benefit, but everybody else's too, can we start everybody off on the same page and get like a, I'll call it a brief primer on trans identity? What do people need to know? Kind of set the framework for us or set the stage, as it were.
Sure. Stevie, you want me to do this? Does that sound
yes,
good?
Yes, please. Yes.
Fantastic. So, unfortunately, Stevie has sat through this 3 million times, but I've done this presentation at AFA, at FEA, with Stevie a number of times, as well as with Beth Stathos, and any organization, I make this offer all the time, but I will go through this through a video conference call for people for free forever, because if you can't have a primer of understanding what we're talking about, then you really can't do this. So, the Cliff Note version of the fun triangle. The triangle has 3 points. So one of them is labeled sex, One of them is labeled gender. One of them is labeled sexual identity or sexual orientation. And typically we use these words often kind of conflated together. The Title IX and Department of Education letters, even in a lot of the governing documents, use sex and gender as synonyms. So I'm purposely breaking them apart so that they can each kind of have their own space. Sex, not the act of, that is a different model. Well, in this particular case, we are talking about biology and anatomy. So sex is genitalia, penis, vagina, chromosomes, XXXY, hormones, estrogen, testosterone, different kind of body parts. I generally refer to them all as innards or giblets, as well as secondary sex characteristics, which are related to our hormones, our chromosomes, and our genetics, like facial hair, body hair, the depth of our voice, a visible Adam's apple, the size of our feet, things like that. These are all physical body parts that we like to think come in a very clean binary, meaning that there are only two options, and everything that has a penis has all of these things and only these things, and anything that has a vagina has all of these things and only these things, and it actually is way more complicated than that. When working with fraternities and sororities, a lot of times they will say that they are a single-sex organization, and I actually don't think that's true, because we don't often know chromosomal, hormonal makeup. I don't know what every organization's ritual is, but it usually does not involve one's genitalia. And we can't put a centrifuge machine next to the mini cupcakes, so we just kind of work on assumptions of what is our physical makeup. So if that's kind of the sex point on the triangle, what I would say fraternity and sororities really are single-gendered organizations. So now we're at the other point of a triangle around gender, which is really more about the roles we take on, the identities we hold for ourselves or tell other people we identify as, and how we express our gender, which I believe really does encapsulate living by a certain set of values. Being a member of a single-gendered organization is where sisterhood or brotherhood or being a member or being a sister or being a brother of those particular organizations show up. Also, there's gender perception, which is the one that we don't have any control over. So even though we can tell people our identities, we can hold certain roles, we can express ourselves a certain way, we really are dependent on other people validating that list of gender or lived list of gender through how people perceive us. So when we talk about being an ally, when someone gives you that information, your job is to validate it, whether you see it to be true or not. That is how that person identifies. So you just go with it. You trust that they know how they identify. So that's kind of gender piece. Specifically, and again, quickly, going to fraternity and sororities, I think we are all single-gendered organizations, of course, with the exception of co-ed organizations, which is kind of an interesting twist to this conversation. But co-ed, as well as fraternity and sororities, still have a very binary conversation around men and women, or masculine and feminine peoples. That's all gender pieces. And then lastly, the third point on the triangle, sexual identity or sexual orientation, are the labels we use to describe the relationships that we are in. So we are heterosexual or straight, gay or lesbian or bisexual or queer, pansexual, omnisexual, asexual. Who knows? There's all different kinds of words we use to describe what kind of relationships we have with other people. When having this conversation inside the context of a fraternity or sorority, even if we're talking about trans inclusion or trans exclusion, what's interesting is the conversation kind of goes to this place of, like, the next thing you know, we're going to let lesbians in or we're going to let gay men in. And the reality is that they're already there, as are trans or gender nonconforming people, which is why this conversation is kind of increasing in number and in momentum. So the Cliff Notes review of the triangle, and then I'll turn it back over to y'all so that we have kind of an even playing field. Sex is what we assume is in your pants. Gender is the pants themselves, like how are they cut, what fabric are they made out of, who are they friends with, what job do they have. It's about the pants. And sexual identity or sexual orientation is what you do, or what I assume you do, when your pants are off. There you go. There is your primer.
That's a really great primer. You took my summation bit out, from my hands, so I don't even have to worry about summing up kind of the 3 points of the triangle. I think
because I do this like almost every day of my life with a group of alumni or current members or undergrads or with many different organizations on many different councils, I've gotten pretty fast at it.
Yeah. No, but I appreciate you laying that groundwork. I think for me, the interesting piece is when you talked about the gender identity versus the gender perception. And I think there are probably a lot of struggles that happen around that for, folks who, their gender identity might be different than what I perceive it to be. And so making sure that we do serve in that ally role and listen to people and what they're saying. I think that's...
Yeah, and I mean, Matt, I know you're kind of a foodie. And so what's important is we already have the skill. Mm-hmm. We just don't think we do. So some of us know someone who thinks they're a really great cook. And you go over to their house for dinner and it's terrible. But it's not polite to be like, you think you're a cook? This is horrible. So what you do is you just say, okay, you can cook. Interesting. What did you do? And maybe next time you should try some salt. But you know that the person identifies as someone who loves to cook. And so you work with how they identify. You don't just disregard it.
Right.
So that's perception.
But no, your comment about kind of accepting and recognizing and affirming kind of my role as a foodie, whether or not you agree with that, that definitely, that mirrors kind of what we ought to be doing with individuals and their gender identity. So I appreciate that. So that's a good analogy, especially speaking to my heart and my stomach there. So, well, with that groundwork laid, and I think, you mentioned, Jess, that you've been having this conversation pretty much every day with a various group of folks. And I think, it's becoming a more common conversation, just given institutional climates and awareness and things that are happening around the country. But talk to us, maybe both of you, about some of the current campus issues or institutional challenges you're seeing around this idea of trans inclusion and, specifically in fraternity sorority life. But what are some of those things that, you're hearing about, you're being asked questions about, you're seeing in that area?
Stevie, do you want to start with kind of from a legal point of view?
When, sure.
The first question that always comes up is Title IX. So if you want to kind of talk about why that's not a thing.
Yeah, so I mean, definitely this is something that is near and dear to my heart. And that was something when I was an active member at Arizona State that I started asking my campus advisor about, what would happen to me, my membership, my status, chapter's membership, and he didn't have any questions, and he kind of pointed to Title IX and said, oh, I'm not sure, Title IX might have something to do with it. So, and then I went to law school, and I researched this issue, and this is what I came up with. Basically, Title IX is a enforcement mechanism on institutions that receive federal funding. So that should definitely, as a first step, we should think that shouldn't apply to us because as private organizations, we don't receive federal funding in this way. And going back to the history of Title IX, we have to go all the way back to 1972. And Indiana Senator Birch Bayh was the main sponsor of Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. And what he said when he introduced this bill in Congress was basically, I'm Senator Bayh, and I think this whole discrimination against women in public institutions, this concept is not cool. So we are going to attach strings to the money that we give you, universities, colleges, high schools, elementary schools, and basically what Senator Birch Bayh said was that if you want this money, you must provide equally activities and programs to both men and women, which is, cool. That makes sense. So you know, how does Title IX then, what does that have to do with fraternities and sororities? 2 years later, in 1974, what is now known as the Department of Education, that entity came in and they said, hey, universities, colleges, we're not sure what this whole fraternity sorority thing is. And what the Department of Education asked was what they were trying to figure out, you know, whether or not colleges and universities could continue to get federal funding if they formally recognize these single-gendered organizations. And so they were going to put, the Department of Education was going to put fraternities and sororities to do this analysis to see whether or not they provided, whether or not universities and colleges provided equal activities and programs to both men and women in the fraternity sorority context. And before the Department of Education could answer that question, Senator Bai, who was the lead sponsor back in 1972, he stepped back in and he said, basically, you know, whoa, 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 hold on. Department of Education, you're not going to get to answer that question. He said in the congressional record that fraternities and sororities have been an integral part of our nation's history, and therefore he proposed an amendment. And what does that amendment say? It basically creates this carve-out for certain the membership practices of certain organizations. So you have social fraternal organizations, you have the Boy Scouts, you have the Girl Scouts, you have the men's choirs, certain choirs, girls, women's choirs. And basically what that means is that institutions that receive federal funding can continue to receive federal funding even if they formally recognize these types of single-gender organizations. Now, if you actually look into the language of Title IX, you don't see you must remain single-sex anywhere. You don't even see the language single-sex anywhere. And so what's really important is that to know is that Title IX doesn't impose any type of obligation on fraternities and sororities to do a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
And on the flip side, Title IX doesn't grant fraternities and sororities any type of right or protection. The only thing really that Title IX mentions is that, you know, to qualify for this amendment, a social fraternal organization has to be made up, a majority of the membership must compose primarily of students attending a higher education institution. That's it. So what was the impact of this amendment? The amendment basically says, hey, universities, from the Department of Education standpoint, hey, universities, we never got the chance to determine if fraternities and sororities are equally provided to men and women. But because of this amendment, you can safely continue to get our federal tax dollars, even if you recognize these types of organizations. So what's important to note is that the focus of Title IX is on the university and the college.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't the federal government saying, hey, fraternal organization, listen up. It's the federal government saying, hey, university, listen up. So I guess kind of just to end this section, I think the biggest challenge right now is kind of having that educational piece, but also helping organizations to talk about their relationship to Title IX. And basically, there is no relationship. And so when I hear, you know, national organizations, chapter members, anyone within our community talk, say, you know, oh, well, our single-sex status under Title IX,
mm-hmm.
or our rights under Title IX, or we're exempt from Title IX. I think those types of statements are inaccurate because we should be talking about ourselves the way that Title IX was originally proposed, is that Title IX doesn't apply to us. So we have no exemptions under Title IX. We don't have any rights, single-sex status under Title IX. It's just Title IX has nothing to do with us. And so that's a really important piece. And I think the biggest thing is, that, you know, when people say, you know, our Title IX exemption, we're not exempt under Title IX because Title IX doesn't apply. Yeah. I guess I'll end it here because I can talk about, you know, okay, well, if it's not Title IX, what is it? But, I'll throw it back to both of you.
Well, and I think, you know, I'll jump in really fast and make the comment that, you know, before you explained it that way, you know, I was thinking about my days back when I was, you know, we'll call it a novice or a rookie FSA. And I remember using language like, you know, you're jeopardizing your Title IX, you know, single sex exempt status. I think I was talking about like fraternities not being able to have, you know, female sweethearts and all this other stuff. But, you know, it's a nice crutch to fall back on. But it's, you know, I think it's interesting and liberating for our national organizations to, you know, not have to worry about violating that exemption because it never actually applied to them. And so they can make these decisions. And I think that's probably, you know, some of the stuff you're going to talk about here in a little bit, that, you know, they're able to, you know, welcome individuals into their organization and this isn't a concern for them.
I would add that one of the things that I think is super important is that's what the law says, but that doesn't mean that every general counsel or attorney or lawyer who serves on a board or volunteers for a fraternity or sorority know that. And even if it is policy, it doesn't mean that people always know what the policy is or that they're implementing it in similar manners. The other piece that comes up quite often is even with some of the things that President Obama did while in office, trans is not federally protected. And so when fraternities and sororities have the ability to come up with incredibly exclusive membership requirements, which I think because we've all been kind of over diversity trained, people's gut reaction is, oh, no, we're not exclusive. And you're like, yeah, you are. You have to pay a certain amount of money. You have to have a GPA at a certain point. There's a lot of things. You have to live your life by subjective values as determined by a group. Like, that's pretty exclusive.
Yeah.
And what I think is really interesting is that when you overlay that practice and then you start talking about diversity stuff, people really do panic. There's also identities that are federally protected that we all know we, of course, do not discriminate against, but we have chapters that do not let in or invite in diverse constituencies because of the culture or the practice of that particular chapter.
Right.
And that varies greatly inside of the same organization based on where the chapters are located. So I think that's an important thing to mention. And lastly, I think is that there's a practice that like, oh, well, we'll just toss everything out to the states and the states can decide, and based on the state non-discrimination policy or the particular campus non-discrimination policy, but not having a consistent rule clearly stated to provide clarity as to who can become a member prong one, and who can stay a member prong two, is really where I think the conversation needs to be. And probably the biggest thing I've learned from playing in the sandbox with Stevie and Beth Sapos is that you can't outsource your exclusivity of who can become a member to a governmental agency and also declare that you're this super elite exclusive organization that grows better men or grows better women when you're outsourcing it to the DMV, or being inconsistent chapter to chapter to chapter.
Yeah, and is that kind of where you get the some either institutions or probably less so institutions, but organizations have that policy of, you know, you are the gender that is on your driver's license or whatever your institution says, that's the gender we recognize. Is that kind of where you're coming from or what you're talking about?
Yeah. So can I talk, I guess this kind of segues into, you know, if it's not Title IX, what is it then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if it isn't Title IX, what is it? And the answer is within your governing documents, because we exist, our organizations exist, because of the First Amendment right to the First Amendment right to association, and that right basically says, hey, we, as a group of men or women, were coming together for this common purpose, these common values. And because these values are so critical to who we are as an organization, because it's at the heart of our identity, we can only admit men, or we can only admit women into our organization, thank you and goodbye. But as I think we are all aware right now, for various reasons, we are struggling to protect that First Amendment right. And, you know, I guess I won't mention specifics, but there are certain activities or habits that we have come, behaviors that we often come across with the populations that we deal with that are inconsistent about why we exist. And those inconsistent activities slowly chip away at our First Amendment protections. And somewhere among all these conversations about, you know, living by our values, displaying behaviors that are consistent with our purpose and our values, there's this conversation of trans membership. So basically, if you look at your governing documents, this is why we've existed even long, and for many organizations, long hundreds of years before this idea of Title IX even came up. Mm-hmm. So these pieces of paper basically say, you know, here are values, here are purposes, and here are the reasons why we can only admit men or women. And so I think what's really important to remember is that the membership decision rightfully belongs where it should, and that is to each organization. So, you know, don't think about Title IX. It's up to you. It's always been up to you, just the same way that you can put requirements on GPA, the same way that you can put requirements, these very subjective requirements on, you know, whether or not someone has the potential to live up to your values, your purpose, your ritual. It's with your governing documents and what you're going to have to look to interpret, you know, what does man, woman, male, female mean now that we're, you know, in 2017? And do those definitions, do they incorporate this concept of a trans student? You can look at your history, your purpose, your values, and you can say, you know, because these values are critical, so critical to who we are, we can only admit men, and this is what we believe a man to be. And at the time of initiation, when we actually make that membership decision, you have to identify as a man. But after initiation, we believe in supporting all of our members in their lifelong journey toward brotherhood or sisterhood, regardless of what happens. Cool. Long the end. Yes. Or your organization can say, you know, we can only admit men, and we believe that maintaining this male identity is so critical throughout our members' lifetime, and we will only support those who remain that way. Okay, that's cool too. So it's really breaking apart, you know, what does it take to become a member? Mm-hmm. And after you become a member, what does it take to remain a member? And does, you know, identifying as a man, as identifying as a woman, is that what is required to be a member and to continue to be a member? Now, I think what Jess was hinting upon is, you know, depending on how you answer these questions for your organization, it's going to be different for each organization because you were founded for different reasons, and you continue to exist for different reasons. So there's not a one-size-fits-all recipe for this approach, but I think what's important to remember is that there are certain risks depending on which way you lean. And I know that, and this is based upon conversations that and anecdotes that I've heard about, you know, a national organization saying, oh, you know, we'll admit anyone whose identity document reflects male at the time of initiation, which is great, right? Because now we have a legal document. It's less scary to have this conversation. We can point to, you know, the driver's license or, you know, the school ID that says male, and, you know, we're good. We're safe. We're protected. The end, right?
Right.
Maybe not. I think it's a good first step to acknowledge, you know, I think I want to acknowledge it's a great first step to have a policy in place. But if you dig a little deeper, you know, we are in the business of creating, defining, building men of character, women of character. And so how is that possible, you know, if we're in the business of doing this, you know, is it, how private are we if we are allowing the lady at the front desk of the DMV to make part of that determination? Because that decision, you know, we look at the driver's license and we say male. So the lady at the base, at the front desk of the DMV basically was like question one to whether or not you can become a member of our organization. And so that, and so I guess if you did go even a little bit beyond that, you know, was the lady at the front desk of the DMV, does she have your purpose and values in mind when she was putting mail on the driver's license? I certainly don't think so. And, you know, and I guess situation number two that was just brought up, you know, like, okay, then we'll just leave it to the state. So we'll leave it to campus by campus. And we'll say, if, just say, for example, if the state has a non-discrimination policy that includes gender identity, or if the campus has a non-discrimination policy that includes gender identity, then, you know, we'll allow trans students to go through recruitment and become members within those specific chapters. And my concern there is, you know, how about your First Amendment right? Because as a private organization, what creates your First Amendment right and what will protect you is those national or international governing documents. And so based upon that piece of paper, you know, that document should have the same meaning regardless of where you are. You could be in Alabama, you could be in California, you could be at Arizona State, you could be at Washington State. Your membership policies, your membership requirements should be the same across the board. And that is to, because you're, you know, it doesn't change if you cross state lines. It's the one document. So that is one way to possibly weaken your First Amendment protections, is if you have 50 different interpretations depending on what state you're in, or actually maybe hundreds of different interpretations depending on what different campus you're on. So the considerations are numerous depending on how each organization comes out on each of these questions. But those are some things to think about.
Well, and, you know, the other piece that makes me think of too is, you know, what about a student that joins an organization, you know, and they then transfer to a school in a totally different state that has different rules regarding gender identity and different protections. And, you know, they're a member of this group, but that group could say, no, not here, and, you know, refuse them without that national, you know, using those national governing documents as kind of the measure instead of relying on states or institutions. And so I think, you know, that's an important thing to note, to consider, you know, not just the organization, but the individual members and the humans who are involved here. So,
you also have to take into consideration, if we are going to, I mean, if people do look at driver's license, is that the gender marker that's on a driver's license or social security card or birth certificate or registration documents, someone could have transitioned prior to even enrolling in college.
Right.
So then if some organizations are like, no, we do not want trans people in, we will only accept people whose documents consistently say man, that doesn't mean that they're a cisgender man or a trans, not a trans person. People can transition early in life, in high school, they could be a non-traditional college student. I joined, which I think is interesting around language, right, is that I joined my sorority, which is actually called a fraternity because the word sorority didn't exist yet, when I was in graduate school, after college, after I had already been in the Peace Corps, after I worked full-time for a year, then I joined my organization. So our limits of, whenever someone thinks like, I've got this super easy, it is actually quite simple, but it's not easy because there's multiple layers of things to be involved with, which I feel like we're hijacking your podcast, but that brings me to undergraduates, the campus professionals that are looking after the development, leadership, and identity development of the undergraduates, the traveling consultants that were undergraduates 2 minutes ago, who work for national organizations, those national organizations' staff, as well as the volunteers who serve on boards or councils or house moms or regional mentors or alumni volunteers, and then the councils and the people who work for those councils as well as volunteer for those councils. So what ends up happening is every one of those levels points the finger to someone else to make this decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts everyone in a strange circumstance. And so I'm actually working with one organization right now that, Stevie, you're going to love this. They have a policy that they have written down on one sheet of paper, and the executive director is allowed to read that statement, but they are not allowed to put it in writing or repeat it more than once. That's it. They are allowed to say it once. And then what ends up happening is that doesn't answer questions. So there's no follow-up. There's no further questions. It doesn't help with interpretation of what that policy means. And the campus professional is now stuck in the middle. So when they call national offices, they get routed to, like, public relations or general counsels. So it, like, gets escalated really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of playing hot potato, why don't we just sit down and actually write what you want to do? Trust your governing documents. Trust the founding values of your organization and determine, just like Stevie said, who can become a member and who can stay a member and stick to it. That's it. That's all we do.
Yeah, well, you know, and just to your point about hijacking the podcast, I think one of my favorite things is finding people who are really smart and just letting them talk. And so, you know, hi, you're both really smart and I'm letting y'all talk. And, you know, you know, kind of questions and things that I had in advance, and you've been answering a lot of them about, you know, challenges and some of the things that we're facing. And I think a lot of it comes back to, you know, let's get those governing documents straight and stop messing around. But, what I'm thinking about is, so how can we, you know, how do we make some of this stuff happen? I think, you know, I'd love it if you talked to, like, we'll call it, you had the triangle, I'll call it the square. And so, you know, you've got your national organization, headquarters staff, all of that. You've got alums, undergraduate student members, and then fraternity sorority professionals that are on the campus grounds. And what can each of them do to kind of help further this work? Further kind of the inclusivity of our organizations.
Stevie, do you want to go first?
Yeah. I guess the most important thing is to not be afraid to have this conversation, because I think at this point, you're not going to be the first one to have come up with a membership policy. But I think the most important piece is that whatever process, internal process, it requires to amend a bylaw, to amend a constitutional provision, that you follow that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if it requires, you know, a meeting of the convention, which happens, you know, every second year, then that's the process that you have to go through. Because I think that'll be, even if it's a difficult conversation, you know, then it will require education, and which is where Jeff totally comes in, and all these other pieces. But, you know, this isn't going to be a new thing that you can invent a new process for. You just have to go through whatever internal process that you already have.
Yeah, so the roadmap is kind of already laid out for organizations who want to do this.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
I think what I'm noticing is there's this, like, quantifiable need. So that organization I was just referencing, they're keeping track of how many phone calls they're getting about this particular topic at a national level. And where I think it was last academic year, they got 3 calls. And just fall semester of this academic year, they got, like, 38 calls.
Oh, wow.
So Bethstathos keeps track of the number of minutes that she spends on the phone about this topic, and it's roughly about an, I think, didn't she say it's like an hour and 22 minutes? I guess that's not rough, that's pretty specific. An hour and 22 minutes for every phone call. So what I've been telling, when I've been working with councils, executive councils, is, does your executive director have something else they need to be doing? for an hour and a half, 30-something times a semester?
Mm-hmm.
My guess is yes. So, like, get on it and just make a decision. But people are really terrified of being first. They're really terrified of being last. They're really terrified, to be completely honest, they're really terrified of genitalia. They're really terrified of parents.
Mm-hmm.
Trans women seem to elicit way more fear than trans men. People are very, very worried. The last time I had this conversation, I wish I had a picture of their face when I said this, but they're very worried about penises being inside of sorority houses. To which I have said, there are already penises inside of sorority houses. And there's like a complete denial that people are already having sex, let alone mixing things up inside the buildings. So at some point in time, I think, from a place of empathy, I think what's really important to understand is there's a lot of stuff we just don't want to acknowledge that we know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to think about things not following the rules perfectly. There's a huge stereotype connected to trans women that related to kind of this pedophile or this, like, wolf in sheep's clothing, which is deeply rooted in sexism. Not just because someone has a penis does not mean they're a sexual predator. And those without penises are not, like, innocent sheep, like, targets and weak. So until we really debunk those kind of pieces, I think this is going to be a really hard topic for people.
Mm-hmm.
And when I work with folks, people get distracted by religion, politics, homophobia, biphobia, when in reality, this is your organization, and you really get to pick and choose. So I think it puts executive directors in hard places, and I think it puts national staff in challenging places. I think it puts campus professionals in really challenging places because they're the ones working with a gender nonconforming student, undergrads who are totally down with this, but they have to say, like, national offices or national councils aren't, or undergrads that also would find this really problematic.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much ageism in the conversation as well that it's the old people who will never approve this. And what I'm finding is old people have been on the planet longer, so they have more likely of a chance of having a trans person in their life. They've supervised a trans person. They have a trans kid. Whereas undergrads, I still meet undergrads at least once a month that have told me they've never met a gay person. So there's a lot of things kind of moving that need to really be, like, paused and then make a very simple decision. Who can become a member? Who can stay a member? I also think that NALFO and NAPA are much further ahead in these conversations than the NIC, the MPC. MPHC is gaining a lot of momentum right now. And it's simple. It's just not easy. So I try to come at this with a place of empathy,
mm-hmm.
but that empathy has to exist because of sexism and ageism and just general fear. But I don't know how to replace that quickly.
Yeah, and you know what you're talking about is, as I was thinking about this conversation, you know, so one of the things I talk with my partner about a lot is, you know, she loves intersectionality, and that's something I'm still, like, you know, I want to just study one thing, but. You know, we talk a lot about how everything is interrelated, and what you're talking about is that same thing, right? You know, it's a conversation around gender. It's a conversation around sexuality. It's a conversation around all of these different things, and dismantling some of the notions and prejudices that have existed around those for a long time, or even just the norms in society that have existed around those, and being okay with kind of going against all of those things to say, hey, we want to be welcoming. We want to be inclusive. And so one of the things that I want to make sure to touch on is I know that y'all have had some good successes in this work. And I don't want people to think that, hey, you know, nothing's happening and we're just waiting and waiting and waiting. But, you know, can you talk about some of the successes y'all have had working with different groups to kind of work on this issue?
Fancy Stevie, do you want to go first?
No. Do you want to take this?
Sure. So, I mean, I think, and I'm reading into the pause, but I think what's important is that the organizations that have done, who really did take the quote-unquote risk, or maybe it's italicized into the quoted, who kind of did something first,
mm-hmm.
all of them have had edits that they had to make to their original statements or policies or position statements. When it was rolled out unanimously, when in practice, there were things they didn't think about. So I think it's really important to say that nobody has nailed this.
Right.
There are some organizations that are a little bit ahead, and they're still struggling. Some organizations that I would have said would have been like the role model group, as far as being super, super inclusive, super, super clear, had elections. So now they have all new executive leaders, and it's being reexamined and looked at and questioned in different ways. I think that for me, it's not about providing inclusive spaces for every organization, and that's usually pretty shocking for people. For me, a success is for governing folks of an organization to find their governing documents, read them, internalize them, and respect them to a place where they get very clear about who can become and who can stay a member. To me, that is success. I don't think there's a lot of people who have 100% nailed this across the board. I guess that one more thing I would add, and then Stevie, you're up if you have any. But one of the things I've noticed specifically within fraternities is there really is a space, and maybe this is because I'm a woman, but I do not see this in sororities. I do not see this amongst women, but I do see this in fraternities amongst men. There is a trust of the undergrad that I don't see in sororities.
Mm-hmm.
And that alumni or board members really do trust the decisions that undergrads are making in reference to their own chapters. And there's something about that that is so inspiring, and especially with everything going on in the world right now, like the ability to trust someone's judgment, I think is huge. And I think specifically of a fraternity I was at this summer at their annual meeting, and the undergrads, really, they just couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that they were actually going to be supported and backed up by the board and the alumni. And that was a really beautiful thing to watch. But I feel like for these men, it was the first time they realized it was their organization. With great disappointment, I do not see that anywhere close to that with sororities. But I just don't think women trust each other in general. That's a different workshop.
Yeah. But I think that's a really cool success to see, is that trust being placed in the undergraduate members who, you know, are faced with this decision on the, you know, on the day to day, and saying, hey, you all are really the face of our organization. You're the ones that make the news, and we're going to trust you to make these decisions and listen to you. And so I think that's a really cool success.
I guess what I would say after, you know, Jess took the lead and I had some time to think about it, is I think that what I think is awesome is the how far and how willing people are to have this conversation now. I know that Jess came out with her Beginning the Conversation guide back in 2008, and I think that that needed to be done because no one was having the conversation. And then even when I wrote my own article back in 2012 on mm-hmm. Title IX and the single set quote-unquote exemption, I guess it was very difficult to receive responses because I think people were still grappling with the issue, but slowly over the years people are now starting to understand the nuance between Title IX and how it doesn't impact us as private organizations. And I think what's exciting is that organizations on the national, international level are starting to want to actually have this conversation and be like, let's do it right. Let's try to have, you know, implement a policy that is consistent with our governing documents, but is also well-worded. And, like, to me, that's very exciting. And to be able to actually have people reach out to me rather than me trying to start a conversation with them saying, you know, we want your help to really craft a written policy. I think that's great.
Yeah, well, and I appreciate both of, you know, your willingness to really work and advocate in this. You know, one of the last things I want to touch on, this month I'm focusing a lot, the month being February. I know we're in January, but we're about to be February. You know, this month I'm focusing a lot about diversity and inclusion in fraternity sorority life. And one thing I want to make sure is that people can continue these conversations. And so, you know, I was hoping, I don't want you all to be doing all the labor and constantly explaining things. And so I was wondering if you could provide some resources or things for people to go to educate themselves more on this topic. I know, you know, both of you have written extensively in perspectives, and you've done presentations for AFA annual meeting, but what are some other things that people can go to start having more conversations around this topic?
Yep, for AFA this year, I actually put everything into a Dropbox so that if anybody wants to send me an email at Jess, J-E-S-S, at goodenoughnow.com, I'm happy to send you the link to the Dropbox. And the idea is that people can add whatever they want to. It's open to anybody who has the link. But Stevie's work is in there. A bunch of the articles are in there. One of the favorite things I think that we've done is Stevie and I answered a Q&A for Essentials, which really gets to a lot of the questions that we are constantly asked. And some of them are pretty off-the-wall questions, but we just went ahead and answered them. but that's in there. And then I also put together a trans assessment so that people inside their own organizations can kind of look around and see, as a starting place, like, where are we? What are we doing? What language do we use? So I'm happy to share that with anybody who'd want. Just drop me an email, jess@goodenoughnow.com.
Awesome. And I'll put a link to your contact information in our show notes, too, so people can, you know, get at you. So other thoughts or resources? Stevie, I'm pretty sure you're going to say, everybody read your governing documents. I'm pretty sure that's, you know, a big one.
I actually wasn't going to say that. That is certainly a good suggestion. I think, you know, the legal piece is going to require a lot, some time to digest. And it's going to require reading and rereading and rereading some more to really understand where this conversation goes. And so there are two pieces that I have written, both within the Fraternal Law newsletter. One, issue 127 from November 2013 introduces you to what Title IX is, and basically it kind of summarizes the way that I did here, you know, how what really Title IX is. And then in November of 2014, one of my fraternity brothers, Nathan Narrowsmith, and I take that conversation a little bit further, and this is issue 132 about what some considerations that organizations should have when implementing a transgender membership policy. So I think those are two good starting points to having the conversation. Obviously, following up with Jess and myself with any questions is always a good third step. Or second step, or first step.
Awesome. And I know there's a new book that's coming out. I haven't read it, but I've seen some really good stuff about it from Z. Nicolazzo, who used to be an FSA down at Arizona, but is, you know, now a faculty member, I think, somewhere in the Midwest. But no, so Trans in College, I think, is the title of that book. And I think that's probably another good, maybe overview of all of these things, too, for folks. So I want to wrap up and just say how much I appreciate both of you as people, because, you know, Stevie, we haven't met face to face, but Jess, you and I have hung out a bunch, and you know, I always appreciate getting some time with you, and so I appreciate you both as people, but also both as advocates and doing this work that is so important to serve our students on campus. A lot of times, who sometimes feel like they don't have allies or support systems on campus, and so, you know, I'm grateful that they have them in you, and they have them in me, and they have them in so many of our fraternity sorority professionals. So, you know, thanks for being on here and for sharing stuff with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Yep. I echo that.
And that's our show for the day. You can find several of the documents and links mentioned in the show notes, or reach out to Jess at Jess, J-E-S-S, at goodenoughnow.com. As always, if you have comments or questions or ideas for future podcasts, hit me up on Twitter, @MattDeeg, or leave a comment on iTunes. As always, stay curious.